On this episode of Hello Bayan, I speak with Ellen Ogden, a public health practitioner and epidemiologist who has led the polio eradication campaign on behalf of the USAIDS, the US Agency for International Development, for now over 20 years. Polio is an infectious disease caused by the RNA virus poliovirus that can cause severe disability, including lifelong paralysis and culminating in death. We do have effective vaccines against polio, which themselves actually have quite a fascinating history. They include an inactivated vaccine, IPV, developed by Jonas Salk, and an oral live attenuated vaccine, OPV, developed by Sabin. Global vaccination campaigns have now led to really tremendous decreases in polio incidence, but as you can imagine, delivering vaccines to every child on the planet is nothing short of a prodigy, and it has required organizing supply chains to reach the most remote regions, building trusting communities, and even negotiating ceasefires in war-torn areas. Okay, well, hello, I'm very happy to have you. Do you want to start by telling us about your story and the way that you prefer and how you got engaged in the field of polio?
Well, I've always had a passion for public health and infectious disease control. From when I was a very little girl, I started hearing about smallpox eradication and these teams of people that would go out to remote areas of the world and help, you know, curb disease and really make a contribution to the world. So that was always very inspiring. And so I did my education, and my career path was all sort of leading up to that. Experiences in hospitals, in the Peace Corps, running disease control programs, working my way through school and hospitals, all gave me that background that was needed to do the polio eradication work. So that was all very exciting. And I was starting to work in immunization and disease control when I had a Hopkins Fellowship in our Latin America Bureau at USAID. And that's where I got involved in the polio program in the early 1990s. And at PAHO at that time, it was under the direction of Dr. Ciro de Quadros, a brilliant Brazilian physician. And so I got the chance to work with him a little bit. And when USAID was asked by Congress to start a polio eradication program, and USAID was looking around for people who had polio experience, USAID experience, they saw me. And so I applied. Ciro de Quadros encouraged me to apply. And they said yes. And I've been in this position since 1997.
Mm-hmm. It's been quite a journey, I suppose, from then. So you mentioned USAID. What are the other main agencies that are involved in the fight against polio?
So there are six what they call spearheading partners. So WHO, UNICEF, CDC, Rotary International, Gavi, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are the spearheading partners for polio. But USAID and other bilateral donor countries provide the resources and the technical support to make some of that happen.
Okay, and so you've definitely had an overarching view of the field. So if you could kind of summarize the progress that's been made in the last three or two decades, how much has polio regressed geographically in terms of numbers? And also maybe, do you think that what's left is the hardest? For example, when you treat cancer cells with chemotherapy, the residual ones are the most aggressive ones that are going to be the hardest to eliminate. So would you describe that as being the case for polio now?
Well, let me start back when global eradication started in 1988. And the World Health Assembly came together, all the countries in the world came together to say, we're going to eradicate polio. And at the time, there were 125 countries that had polio, close to 400,000 cases a year. All three types of polio, type 1, 2, and 3 wild virus, were circulating at the time. And through mass vaccination efforts, through extensive surveillance for acute flaccid paralysis, which is the signal condition for polio, cases drop dramatically. And today, there are only two countries that have never stopped transmission of wild virus, Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we only have circulation of type 1, wild type 1 right now in the whole world. So the Africa region was certified wild virus free last year in August. It's almost a year anniversary. And so that is a huge, huge global achievement to go from 400,000 cases a year to under 100 cases a year and 125 countries to only two countries. And we've prevented 19 million cases of childhood paralysis.
Wow.
That is an extraordinary global effort towards a common good. But as you say, the last pockets and getting the last cases and raising herd immunity in places that are have active fighting, they are inaccessible. There's myths and rumors about the vaccine. Challenges have prevented us from getting into these very, very last pockets in Afghanistan and Pakistan to get rid of the wild virus. And then in this time frame, what we have also seen is because the vaccine we use, the oral vaccine, is an attenuated, it's not a killed vaccine, we do have some of the weaker viruses that break through, and they go from child to child, especially among unvaccinated or undervaccinated children. And what we're seeing in parts of Africa is the progression of what we call vaccine-derived virus. It actually came from the strongest of the weak ones that came from the vaccine, passage through 2,000, 3,000 children till they start to regain virulence. And we're seeing that happen. But we also have very good tools to boost population immunity to stop transmission of what we CVDPVs, circulating vaccine-derived viruses. Mm-hmm. And there's a new novel OPV type 2 that does not revert back to virulence nearly as much as the original oral polio vaccines. And so we're starting to use those in most countries. And that should get rid of vaccine-derived type 2 and not revert back to virulence. So we're very, very hopeful about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you mentioned some challenges are more mm-hmm. on the biological side of virus reverting mm-hmm. back to virulence and some more on the social side. Have these, the nature of the challenges changed in the past, well, in the past decades you've been working? And do you find that some issues today, such as you said, vaccine hesitancy with social media being much more propagated, do these kind of impose new, entirely new tasks that you weren't faced with at the start?
No, I think you're absolutely right. When we began, you know, people were still very excited about smallpox eradication. They saw the value of vaccines. The memory of these vaccine preventable diseases was still fresh in the minds of many grandparents and parents. And so they welcomed our efforts to get rid of polio. And vaccine hesitancy wasn't a big problem. It came up occasionally. There were myths and rumors that the vaccine causes sterility or it's a plot to sterilize certain ethnic or religious groups. And with good interpersonal communication, good outreach to religious and traditional leaders, we were able to overcome a lot of those myths and rumors when they would pop up. Might take us a little time, but pretty much all over the world, we've had great success in overcoming that hesitancy and lack of confidence in the vaccine. More recently, we are seeing with social media a proliferation of misinformation, negative vaccine information, and it's spreading very, very quickly. And not just sound bites, but videos. And so the speed of information is changing things. So we have to be very good at addressing those with accurate information, but also making sure we're working with influencers and people within the country to understand the real issues and how to provide people with information and convince them to accept vaccination. It's a process, and it's a very emotional one. And often people have very legitimate concerns about the vaccine. So as practitioners, we need to be patient and take the time and explain and go back and explain again, and maybe in a different way. And I think we have to learn better how to overcome these fears because they're legitimate. People worry about their children.
Yeah, and I think as you mentioned, actually speaking to the people, I think it'd be important for our listeners to know that you've done a lot of field work. So you've been in the villages and different continents. And I'd be really eager to hear about your take on that. So obviously you have to accommodate the cultural differences all over the world to not only speak and convince people to accept the vaccines, but also to face all the delivery challenges. So do you have some examples of cultural differences that have required different approaches to get a successful vaccination campaign in the fields?
Mm-hmm. There's so many. Some of my most memorable experiences, I really started doing my field work in India. And at the time, the vaccinators were mostly men. They were mostly Hindu. They were mostly doctors. You know, they had a task to go out and vaccinate people. And they were very straightforward about it, but they would go into predominantly Muslim communities where the men were not home during the day, and there were maybe the women or the grandmothers at home with the children. And in those cultures, you can't, single men just can't walk up to a door and have somebody open the door. It's just not done. And so at the time, many of these communities were tagged as refusal communities because they refused to open their door. So I went to find out more information. Why did you refuse? And I went with one of my colleagues who's very soft-spoken, and he knocked on the door. And I spoke, even though it was English and they didn't understand English, they heard a woman's voice. So they came to the door. And I asked, why did they refuse the vaccination? And they said, well, these other guys were pounding on the door, demanding to see us. We're not allowed to open the door. We didn't have permission from our husbands. And so we did not let them in. And I said, okay, would you let me vaccinate your kids? Oh, yeah, no problem. And so we gathered maybe 200 kids in this community and vaccinated them on the spot. But afterwards, when we went back to discuss what happened, I talked to the team and said, look, you can't approach communities that way. You have to be sensitive to local customs. And then I started seeing this in more and more places. So I actually made a recommendation back to the Indian government that they needed to have more female vaccinators, because they could go in the house, they would be approachable. And other people went out and saw the same thing I did. And finally, the government was convinced that they needed to shift to predominantly female vaccination teams. So within a few years, 95% of vaccinators were women. And we were getting into the houses and finding the sleeping and sick kids, as well as the newborns. And that's another cultural issue in that part of the world. Newborns are kept inside the house for the first 40 days. They just don't come out. So if you want to vaccinate newborns, you have to go in and find them. And only women can do that. So we found through women vaccinators, we're entering more houses, getting more very young children. And that's when you really started to build herd immunity. Staying ahead of the birth cohort in India is not an easy task.
Oh, wow. That's a beautiful story, because it, in a way, it seems brutally obvious, but if you don't have the woman leadership to have that wisdom and to
yeah, introduce this positive change. And it, as you said, it, having women in the workforce is, has been so key to the success of the campaigns.
It has, and we're learning we need women in monitoring roles, supervisory roles, decision-making roles. And slowly the program is getting better. But for many, many years, I was the only woman in a senior position within the whole global polio eradication program. So it's just, you get your little wins where you can and keep spreading it. And when I look back today where we were, tremendous progress in many, many places. We're not there yet. We still don't have a lot of women in the very senior leadership positions within the spearheading partners, but things are definitely better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's undeniable that it's taken a lot of negotiation. And I was very impressed by the story of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So I'd be eager for you to tell us about what that achievement was.
So part of what I do is try to solve problems, figure out what's going on, what are the obstacles, how can we try to come up with joint solutions. And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, back in the early 2000s, there was a lot of active fighting between different rebel groups. And they were not cooperating with the polio teams at the time. And so none of the immunization activities were taking place in Eastern DRC because of active fighting. And so I was asked by our ambassador at the time if I could go talk to these various rebel groups and see if I could get them to agree to stop fighting on the days of the polio campaigns. And so I said, sure, I'm happy to do that. And set off on this, task of meeting with each of the three main rebel groups working in DRC at the time. There were many others, but these were the biggest ones. So I was in Goma, and then up in Baralit, and then in Bunia. And I was working with people who had intermediaries who worked with these various groups. And they set up these meetings for me. And I went in, it was a time when we still had those clear plastic data slides. And I had a map that showed what was happening with polio in that country and how most of the cases were in the eastern part and it was their children getting paralyzed. And I explained about the immunization campaigns and what it would take to get everybody vaccinated. And if they would stop fighting on the days of the campaigns, here's what we could do in terms of bringing in vaccinators and vaccine. And here's how it would all work. Is this something they'd be interested in? And they said, yes, we don't want our kids to get paralyzed, but we want to know that everybody else is going to agree to this too. And so I said, well, that's my task, is I'm going to meet with each of the leaders to see if they'll agree to this plan. And I did, and I went and I explained it. Same talk, same slides, same request, was the same everywhere. And at the end of a week or so, I was able to get an agreement by all of the main rebel factions not to fight on the days of the polio campaigns. And we set the date and we set the process. And I, it was basically a handshake. And I came back and met with our colleagues at WHO and UNICEF and the other implementing partners and said, here's how it's gonna go. And they said, okay. And you follow it exactly as planned because that builds trust. Mm-hmm. On the days that we had identified, everything went very smoothly. The vaccine came in, the vaccinators came in, nobody was fighting, and we got 6 million children vaccinated in Eastern DRC just because you went and talked to them directly and answered their questions and found out what their concerns were and tried to mitigate that. So that was a really big success for all of us. To make sure that DRC is one of the largest countries in Africa, and lots of children getting paralyzed there. So it really means a better life for so many kids. And those ceasefires have been in place since then. I'm actually blanking on what year it was. I think it was 2000 or 2001. And for the most part, all of the various fighting groups and rebel groups have not fought on the days of the polio campaigns. So it's been an ongoing legacy.
One of the ways is, you said, is having a plan. And I suppose the way it does is scheduled vaccination interventions. But another part would be detecting problems when they arise and honing into a hotspot where some polio emerges. And I'm wondering if there are in some cases incentives not to report that, because it's quite a common theme with infectious diseases that they can be, there's a lot of taboo, stigmatization. This is the case with, especially with sexually transmitted diseases like HIV, mm-hmm. We know about leprosy, where individuals are completely mm-hmm. ostracized. So is it the case that polio victims are either outcasts in their community and it wouldn't be raised to authorities?
It's a very, very good question. It doesn't play out exactly the way you're describing it. What normally happens, if a child is paralyzed, one day they're walking, the next day they're not walking. Parents are pretty upset and they take their children almost immediately to a health center or a traditional healer. They investigate. So there's no stigma in the sense of bringing the child to find out what's wrong with them. And that's how our surveillance system works, is that people are trained to detect this rapid onset of paralysis. Mm-hmm. And so we pick up most of these cases pretty quickly. So that's not where the stigma is. Of course, if you are paralyzed and you go back to your community, most of the time those children don't have a normal life. They don't go to school, they don't marry, they're an economic burden on their family. You see them as beggars in the streets. In almost every country you go to, there's people with crippled limbs begging for food or pushing themselves on these sled-like things through the streets, trying to earn money. People with polio have pretty miserable lives in most countries. It's changing very, very slowly with disability rights and people focusing on that. But for centuries, polio survivors did not have an easy life of it at all. But there's no stigma so much in bringing people to the attention of the health facility. So we do see cases. What often happens though sometimes is that there's tremendous political pressure to not report cases because they want to be seen as doing better than they are. Negative incentives, not from reporting the child to the facility, but the facility into the national reporting system. And it doesn't happen often, but it's happened once or twice where we know that there's polio going on, but we're not seeing the cases in the actual reported numbers. And so what the program has done is institute a way of triangulating data so that we can detect if something like that is happening. So one example is at one point people thought they were getting very clever and giving their own stool samples instead of that of the child, or they would take a stool sample and leave it in the sun and then send it off to the lab. But our lab techniques are so much better now that if you grow nothing at all in your stool sample, it comes back with zero growing there. You think there's a problem with the reverse cold chain and somebody did something to that sample. And same thing with genetic sequencing. Even if you do find something that looks weird and you sequence whatever's growing there and it's like, hey, this is the same guy, exactly the same genetic sequence for these 35 stool samples. you know, it's a problem. So we've developed some pretty clever ways of figuring this out. Serology occasionally has been very helpful as well. You know, we get reports of 100% coverage for our immunization campaigns, yet we're still seeing polio cases. And you're like, that doesn't sound right. So you go and do a seroprevalence survey and find out seroprevalence is maybe only 60%, not 100%, or 90%. And it's like, okay, we have a problem with our coverage data. Maybe not every child is getting vaccinated the way the reports are coming back. So the program has become pretty good at finding ways to pick up on inconsistencies, and we've learned to go investigate those. So anything that's discordant, doesn't match up, we try to investigate.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's big goals and eradication targets is great to give a direction, but then if we set these milestones where we expect results and they're not there, it feels like backtracking. And
yeah, I mean, the other big thing is just the culture in which we work in polio. We've tried to create a culture where bringing problems forward is not criticized. You get, it's a benefit. It's in your favor. If you can reveal a problem that we can fix, you're not going to get punished for that. And in so many cultures, if you bring a problem forward to your bosses or something, you know, you get slapped down. It's like, that's not a cultural thing to do. And so the tendency in many places is to hide bad news from your boss. But in polio, we've really made an effort to say we have a zero tolerance for false reporting. We want to know what the issues are. This way we can come up with solutions together to solve it. And that's how we break through each of those plateaus that you get to. It's when new issues come out and you find new solutions for it. But that culture of how you operate becomes very, very important.
Mm-hmm. And I'd be interested in maybe as we stand right now, has all this scientific progress been done? And is it left for implementation of the vaccine programs and civil society? Or are there purely scientific advances that would be beneficial? So you mentioned some more novel vaccines like OPV, some modified formulations. Some of them have been introducing modifications in untranslated region and the polymerase to minimize the risks of virulence. So do you think that developing new vaccines is maybe necessary is not the word, but is it a worthwhile effort, or should we focus our attention on using the ones we have already?
Well, I think we're learning from the vaccine-derived outbreaks that we do need an oral vaccine that is not going to revert back. IPV provides great humoral immunity, but not great mucosal immunity. And so it's not ideal for stopping transmission and replication. It's very good at preventing disability and paralysis. And so that's one of the reasons why the novel NOPV type 2 was created, was because we had removed the type 2 component from the current oral vaccine. There was a big switch in 2016 from trivalent vaccine to bivalent vaccine that contained only 1 in 3, because we had eradicated wild type 2 everywhere in the world. And so the only way you could get type 2 was from the vaccine. So we withdrew that. Unfortunately, there was still some of it lingering out there because you only get one paralytic case for every 200 silent infections for type 2. And so there were places where there was silent circulation. And it took a number of years to passage through children, and we started to see vaccine-derived viruses. So the decision to start developing a novel oral polio type 2 that didn't revert took place many, many years ago, knowing that it was going to be needed at this end stage. And currently in development are also NOPV type 1 and 3 vaccines, which should be available sometime in the next you know, 4 to 5 years. Because that in the end game of polio, once you withdraw the oral vaccine, it can be out there silently. And it may take quite a long time before we see outbreaks or pockets that we miss. So if we can start switching to the novel OPV that doesn't revert as well, those risks go down. So there are still some scientific issues there. I would say the other one that we're really looking at with improved technology today are direct detection methods. So on the diagnostic side, currently we have to collect stool samples 24 to 48 hours apart within 14 days of onset of disease. It has to be packaged in a reverse cold chain, transported back to an accredited laboratory for analysis. And that whole process can take days or weeks. And then the lab part of it also takes a couple of weeks to get the genetic sequencing and all of the information that we need. So if we could find a direct detection diagnostic that's on site, would tell us what we're dealing with, if it's polio or not polio, is it Guillain-Barré or is it polio causing the paralysis? We can start ruling out things that would speed up our response time. So the virus would not have as much time to spread. If we could come in and do a response, you detect something, respond even more quickly, you could save a month in response time. So in the new 5-year strategy for polio eradication, one of the innovations is to look for a direct detection method. So if we get that, that would be very exciting.
So are they PCR-based methods?
To be honest, that is not my area of expertise. Okay. And I would direct you to some of my virologist friends to give you the inside scoop on that. You know, for me, working in the program, in the field, looking at the epidemiology, that would be a big game changer if we could come up with that. But the other part of your question is, we can't wait for that necessarily. So we still need to be focused on doing high quality campaigns. And if we have to reach people with civil society, that has to be better organized. We have to have it consistent across the country, high quality, every round, every child. And those are the tools that we have right now, and we need to make sure that we're using them well and consistently. It's not one or the other.
Right, of course. And when we see these tremendous efforts that are mobilized, it's almost like it's a shame that it's only being used for polio. And if we could use these interventions to kind of multiplex and at the same time be giving other vaccines or even nutrient supplementations are there any cases where delivery of polio vaccines are combined with other things? Or could we consider that for the future? Because that would definitely be doing a 2-in-1 or 3-in-1 or mm-hmm. even more ideally.
Yeah, no, it's great. I love the fact that you're thinking like a public health person. And as a donor, because we're always looking to get as much as we can from every interaction on the doorstep as possible. For many, many years, polio eradication programs have added vitamin A and deworming antihelminthics to the polio campaigns. So for vitamin A, it's usually twice a year during the campaigns that's given as well. And communities really like the fact that you give more than just polio drops. It's really important to be seen as providing multiple services in many of the communities where we work. You want to not only avoid complacency, but you also have to recognize they have other priorities, not just polio. So meeting them where their needs are also is important. In a number of countries, we've done multi-antigen campaigns. Sometimes it's polio and measles, which is the most common. Occasionally there's been other antigens added. It adds a level of complexity. The age groups are different for measles campaigns than polio. measles is an injectable. It doesn't lend itself to house-to-house vaccination quite the way the oral polio vaccine is done, where you can use volunteers to put two drops in every child's mouth. When you're dealing with injectables, you need trained vaccinators. It's usually at a fixed site. So it's not the easiest thing to add an injectable to the oral. Different age groups, different target populations. But it is being done, and we're looking for more opportunities to do that. And who knows what the future holds? You, if we can do health camps where you're providing polio drops and other vaccines and doing some growth monitoring and referring people for nutritional supplementation and doing a couple of other basic things, communities really like that. So you're not just doing outreach with one vaccine, you can provide a little health camp with some key critical things. That seems more manageable operationally.
Mm-hmm. Are there any specific supplements that'd be high on the list, or are there any specific ones that are of particular interest?
I mean, communities certainly want nutrition. And if they can be referred for nutrition supplementation, it often means growth monitoring and screening. It's quite difficult sometimes to bring food to an immunization site. So you often have to, again, you think about the operations, what it takes to bring a team of people out. I can share some photos with you about how challenging it is to get things into these remote areas. So it has to be manageable. Quite often, even just providing soap for hand washing is well received. In many places, we give hygiene kits. So a bucket and some soap and a washcloth or a toothbrush, a comb. People really, really appreciate that. If we can bring a nurse to do some basic care, people have burns, they have cuts, basic things like that that they may not have access to, those things are greatly appreciated. Bringing a pediatrician to a health camp is fantastic. If you can bring a midwife or a gynecologist, those are the things that people really are looking for. But there's not many of them. They can't be there every time, every round. So it takes coordination with other programs. It needs an understanding of what the needs are in a particular community. It takes a lot of organization to have all the people with all of their needs for each of their programs all ready at the same time to deploy for an outreach visit or a health camp. So the level of effort to organize and coordinate these things is quite substantial, but it also has a great value. So we work country by country, place by place to see what's manageable. Yeah, we try very, very hard to have integrated approaches.
And I suppose in such success is quite a double-edged sword, because of course you reduce the burden of mortality and morbidity extremely, but as the threat fades, so does the fear. And so that's a major issue with vaccines, not just with polio, but vaccines essentially prevent and remove from sight what they treat. That's their purpose, their prophylactics. But then that means that in the populations, the fear of that fades, and maybe the value of the enterprise seems to diminish, and people start thinking it's maybe not that big of a deal anymore. So how can we overcome this? How can we remind ourselves that continuing these vaccine campaigns are important? And maybe personally, what drives you to continue? What makes you convinced that, we have to continue this fight, that it's worthwhile?
Oh, goodness. What we find when there's what we call complacency, when people are tired of campaigns or tired of the knocks on the door, they don't see the disease anymore. Quite often it is reminding them that there are still people living with polio, and showing them the faces of the kids in their area and saying, look, these are your children. This happened to him last year. you don't want this to come back. You have to find a way to personalize it or make it valuable. It's not numbers or dots on a map. It's not this abstract thing. These are real children getting paralyzed. And so how you remind people about that, we, in many countries, not every country, many countries, we work with polio survivor groups at their request. They want to be part of the solution. And they are some of our best advocates. And they've had marches where polio survivors will congregate in front of the National Palace, the president's office, and say, this is still important. They are spokespeople. They will go meet with people in their communities. You know, for those of us that are not suffering from these disabilities, we try to amplify their stories and remind people what it was like, and that we want to move on to other bigger programs, but we can't do it. We haven't quite sealed polio eradication yet. And, you know, what keeps me going is the knowledge that we can do it. We've done it every place but two countries. It won't take very much to have a breakthrough in those few countries to get those kids vaccinated. Just like DRC, we threw our hands up. 6 million kids are not vaccinated. What are we going to do? It's going to be impossible. You can't do it. And then the right person, the right interlocutor is able to negotiate whatever it is that's needed to flip the switch. And all of a sudden, 6 million kids get vaccinated. Happened in Angola, it happened in Somalia, it happened in many, many countries where you got the one or two people you needed to convince, turn the whole thing around, and whole parts of countries opened up. And so we're still chipping away at all of that. But there is great hope that we're going to find a solution to getting access into the remaining places, that we will be able to vaccinate all of the kids there. We'll overcome any hesitancy or confidence issues that are there. And we all see it as still doable. It will prevent so many kids in the future from getting paralyzed. There's also financial, just putting on the cold donor hat here for a second. It's going to save billions of dollars in future costs. If you can eradicate this disease, all of the treatment costs, the additional opportunity costs of this, the cost of campaigns, the cost of all of this, the vaccine in itself, all eventually will go away once we're 100% sure that polio is gone, much like smallpox. We're not vaccinating. The cost to vaccinate people is not there. We're not running campaigns anymore for smallpox. So we save all of those future potential dollars. So the investments today, even though they're high, save us far greater resources later. So that's one argument that's often used. But for me, it's really, we can do this. We can protect kids. We can make sure there's no unnecessary paralysis. We should go for it. And the fact that we haven't done it, it's, I think, on us. It's not on communities. We have to find a better way of reaching there. So I still think those are things that we can have an impact on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those words are really important, because it's quite tempting to say, well, why is eradication worth it? It's going to take so much more time, so much more resources than just reducing it to a very minimal frequency, but not to zero. But as you say, there is this extreme added value of achieving like smallpox complete eradication. And what also strikes me when I think about it is that there is, in saying, humans, it's like a fatalist view that humans will have to suffer from diseases. That's an essential part of humanity, and that it's this unnatural achievement to completely get rid of a disease. But we've proved it before. Hopefully, we've narrowed it down to two countries, so I definitely have hope.
And there's success on the veterinary side. They got rid of Rinderpest. So polio would actually be the third disease, second human disease, but third disease to be eradicated.
Mm-hmm.
So the technology is improving, our understanding of how to run successful campaigns, how to engage with communities is improving all the time.
Mm-hmm. So. It's an incredible story. And then maybe, obviously public health right now is a key concern. Do you maybe have some words for the younger generations that are starting in this field? How can we step up to the threat of infectious diseases? What are the measures that we have to do for public health in a world, in a post-COVID world, I suppose?
Well, in a current COVID world, we're building on our polio work right now for COVID. I'm a part of the COVID task force at USAID and very much trying to build on the lessons learned. So how you introduce a new vaccine, the need to engage with communities, the need to have very good, strong, what we call micro planning, to know where all the people are. How many vaccinators do you need? How is the surveillance guiding all of our efforts? Many of the same tools that we use for polio, we're trying to use for COVID. And certainly on the vaccine introduction piece of it. And that's a tremendous opportunity to learn how to do disease prevention, detection, response in countries. And I'm actually quite excited. I think the new mRNA vaccines and the new technologies are going to lead to many new vaccines in the next 10 to 15 years. And if we have really effective vaccines, there's going to be eradication or control efforts to get those in use. And those systems that you need to be effective, it's not just the vaccine, it's how you deliver the vaccine, how you get people to accept the vaccine. We're going to be building on this, I think, over the next 15, 20, 30 years as new vaccines and technologies come on board. I think it's a very exciting time for public health. Vaccine awareness has never been higher. Probably since the Sabin and Salk race to the vaccine in the 1950s. So we have, even if you agree or disagree, vaccine awareness is very, very high right now. So it's a very good time, and it's a great field to go into. And I really loved it because it brings me in touch with communities, inspirational people. I bring in my knowledge of science, of epidemiology, understanding what we call the 360 view, understanding socioeconomic and gender issues, what's motivating people at the community level, and bringing all of that knowledge and skill set together to help solve these problems, to me is just fascinating. So I'm not bored. People ask me when I'm retiring. I have no plans to retire. So there's still so much to do and so much to learn.
Mm-hmm. There's something so striking about public health in that it's invisible, but there's this legion of little hands weaving a safety net for society, and we just don't see them, but we owe so much. So, you're leaving quite a legacy, even though it's in non-victims and non-deaths, but I find it beautiful. So thank you so much. Thank you for your work and for this interview.
Oh, thank you. It's really been an honor. And I wish you every luck and success, and my best to all your listeners. Everybody has something to contribute here.
Thank you so much. If you've listened up to this point and think that maybe you would like to play a part in the polio eradication story too, I will attach some links to donate in the podcast notes. These are with trusted organizations, which are the spearheads, as we mentioned earlier, and they include UNICEF and Rotary.